Do you like books? I mean, really, really like books? Then you're in the right place. Each week, your host, Sam Hankin, interviews the best of today's top-selling authors and the up-and-coming superstars of modern literature. This is The Avid Reader. Here is your host, Sam Hankin.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of The Avid Reader. Today, our guest is Yaa Jessie. Yaa is the author of Homegoing, published earlier this month by NOF. Yaa was born in Ghana and raised in Huntsville, Alabama. She holds a BA in English from Stanford and an MFA from the Iowa Writers' Workshop, where she also held a Dean's Graduate Research Fellowship. She lives in Berkeley. This is her first novel, which has been universally acclaimed and is, not to be facetious, the most anticipated summer read of this year. The Wall Street Journal, Vogue, Miami Herald, and soon the New York Times have taken a turn at explaining the dark and rich texture of this timeless yet clocked history of two sisters born, forged, if you will, in fire, and the bequest, if that is what it is, of corollary lifetimes, one born of slavery and then of life in America, and one born to a higher standard of life but one that remains in Ghana. The book traverses the 18th century through present-day times, and in so doing, articulates slavery, curse, the sins of the mother being visited upon succeeding generations, and the results of actions that reverberate down the long corridors of time. When I first looked at the book in the family tree, I thought, oh no, a family tree. I hate family trees. Ever since Gabriel Garcia Marquez, when the family tree just led me back to a series of Aurelianos, which drove me crazy. But it turns out that this tree, much like the epigraph, which is essentially that none of us can see the forest for the trees, helps us to understand the basis and the nature of the novel and its skein of protagonists. Hi, Yaa, and thanks for joining us today.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, so did you ever think that this was going to happen?
No, I never thought. I just, you know, I feel like most writers, I was just kind of writing in the dark, unsure of whether or not my work would ever see light. So it's great to be in the light.
It's so funny because, you know, all the reviews are great and all that, but the Wall Street Journal has to has to include the price and the fact that it was a bidding war, because it is the Wall Street Journal.
It's true.
So before we go into telling us a little bit about the background of the book, tell me a little bit, because it was very curious in all your interviews, about your two trips to Ghana. Once when you were 16 with your family, and then the second time when the seeds for your novel were planted.
Yeah, the first time I went to Ghana, I was actually 11. It was the summer after sixth grade. I went with my whole family. And it was the first time that we had gone back since moving to America when I was about 2 years old. And so that trip was really important to me. It was kind of just my first chance to meet everyone, basically. My entire family still lives there, other than my immediate family, my parents and my brothers. So I met my grandparents for the first time, and my aunts and uncles and cousins. And it was an overwhelming trip, but a great one. And then I went back by myself, kind of on a solo pilgrimage kind of trip, the summer after my sophomore year at Stanford. I had received a grant called the Chapaluji in order to research a novel. And I had kind of a different idea in mind. I kind of wanted to go to the central region of Ghana, where my mother's side of the family is from, and a place where I hadn't spent really any time. The idea for that novel wasn't really panning out, and I was kind of bummed about it. But then a friend came, and we decided to visit the Cape Coast Castle, which is the slave castle. And really, that just opened up the idea for this novel completely, and it was really the genesis of Homegoing.
Why did the sign, and you can explain why the sign was there and what it meant, the book of the same name. Why did the sign, The Door of No Return, make you angry? And what exactly were you angry at that early stage?
Yeah, I think just that sign, just the visualization of understanding that when the slaves left this castle, it would be the last time that they ever got to see their home country. That really struck me. You know, I left Ghana when I was two, but under entirely different circumstances, obviously. And I have gotten to go back, gotten to meet family members that I never met before, gotten to feel reconnected to my roots. And the fact that African Americans and other descendants of slaves in other nations have been totally cut off from that memory, from that ability to meet their family, it really struck me, and I was like both angry and I guess deeply sad to realize that.
And the book that was The Door of No Return was written about, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago. Did you read it when it first came out, when you were like 12, 15, 17?
No, I did not read it when it first came out. I read it, I started reading it in 2012 when I started the version of the book that is this. I got it really at the beginning of my time at the Iowa Writers Workshop when I was really settling into this novel.
But the thing about The Door of No Return and the only complaints against it that I can see are that it didn't go nearly as deeply as you did, kind of almost literally, into what was happening under that floor. So why don't, as we're going into, you know, and I'm doing it in a haphazard way, but why don't you tell a little bit about what the castle meant, who lived above, who lived below?
Sure. So The Door of No Return did a great job of talking about everybody who lived above. So there were the British soldiers, obviously, and the thing that I learned on the tour of the castle was that the British soldiers would sometimes marry the local women, so the Fanti women, the Ga women who lived in that area at the time, and those women also lived in the castle. And then there would be children from the unions of these soldiers and the local women who were sometimes sent abroad to school, to England to school, and then came back and kind of, you know, established a place for themselves in Ghana. And kind of upstairs, it was just a bustling center of trade, not just obviously the slaves that were held beneath the castle, but there were textiles and, you know, different food and animals. And so it seemed like a pretty bustling center for trade. And then the tour guide took us downstairs to the basically the basement of the castle, which is where the slaves were held. And you got to see things like the male dungeon, the female dungeon, the solitary confinement quarter that they kept the slaves who were behaving poorly. And then also the door of no return was down there as well.
So when in the beginning, when James marries, I'm putting it in quotes, Afia.
Right.
And she's a wench. He's married at home, and he sends his son to England to be educated. How did they treat the fact that they already had wives, and that they called these wives wenches? Did they just abandon them when they left and went back home?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, from my understanding, it seems that a lot of them, you know, if they fell in love with their wives, they would, or their wenches, I suppose, their Ghanaian wives, they would sometimes stay in Ghana after their commitment had ended. But otherwise, I think they left. I think they went back to England and kind of resumed their lives in their own home country.
It's interesting the way you portray your characters and their physical appearance. And am I saying, is it Afia or Effia? And is it Essie or Essie? Am I saying it?
Afia, and then it's Essie.
Okay. So Afia, you portray as, and call her name, is as this beauty. So you have in your mind this image of what she looks like. But then you have the husband of the first one who marries someone from Ghana. And you paint him as being this florid, red-faced kind of person. And you do that throughout the book where you really, the physical attributes of the people actually seem to reflect to a certain degree their interior. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if I was totally aware of the fact that I was doing that, but yeah.
It does seem like, from what I've read too, that you kind of channel so much of this because like I was saying at the beginning. And, you know, when I said that about 100 Years of Solitude, I didn't know when I was saying that actually that's one of your favorite books, and you know, until I read the interviews.
Yeah, I don't know if it's one of my favorite books, but it's one of the books that really, really freed me up, I think, to write this novel. I mean, you talked about seeing the family tree at the front and being angry at it. I kind of had a similar experience. But then I finished the book and loved it so much that I was like, oh, it's okay to have to flip back to the family tree. Like, that doesn't totally ruin the experience for a reader, which made it okay for me to include a family tree at the front of my novel.
It's just that Marquez is just, you know, this all the magical realism, which a little tiny bit is in yours too. But it's just it's just the Aureliano,
yeah,
which drove me crazy. But the thing was, eventually you got it, you know, and that was what's so amazing. And your family tree is much more followable in that almost each of these could be standalone short stories, which I didn't get until I was driving over here today.
Yeah, it's true. Each chapter follows a different descendant of those first two half sisters, and they really get their own voice, their own, you know, place in the sun. And so in that way, you know, you can read them on their own.
Yeah, and it's funny, you do what, to simplify things again, kind of like what Game of Thrones does, is that if you look at Ness and Sam, you really want them, like with Ned Stark, you really want them to succeed. And then what happens. And it's like, hey, why did she do this to me? You know?
Yeah.
And it's,
that might be my first comparison to Game of Thrones.
I didn't really want to do it, but I just thought of Ned Stark. So when you talk about complicity in this slavery, and you say that there was complicity, as you say, on your side, whose side is that, and how did that play out? I mean, between the Ashanti Empire and the Golden Stool of Asante and the Fontes as well.
Yeah, I mean, it was something I had never really learned about. Obviously, I didn't go to school in Ghana. I grew up in America, so I'm not really sure how slavery is taught there or discussed there, but you know, this huge monument to slavery, the Cape Coast Castle, is on Ghanaian soil. You know, we are the ones who have to look at it. So I think there is a sense that we should talk about it a little bit more than we do. I think the process, as I understood it, was that, you know, the different ethnic groups would have wars or raids or whatever it was, and then once they had captured people, they would take them down to the coast and sell them to whichever Europeans were buying at the time, be it the British or the Dutch. And then we know what the other side of that story was. I don't know, you know, how much awareness they could have had about what was to become of the people that they were selling, in terms of how slavery ended up looking in America. But obviously, you know, there is a role that they played in it. And one that I think that we should talk about a little bit more.
Which is really, was telling to me, because yesterday the third Global Slavery Index came out, and it says, it says there's 48 million people living in slavery in all 167 countries in the index. The highest is India and then Korea. And it's like, once again, you're kind of like saying no one really pays attention to it except this global survey. And as in your book, the definition of slavery is kind of a movable feast. You can be a slave in so many ways, whether it's to drugs, as one of your characters is, or by a master. And I think you do that well throughout your portrayal of all the characters. And what's I think the cover is great. The epigraph is great. And
thank you, yeah.
The cover, I mean, because you're talking about water and fire throughout the book, with earth in the form of a stone also included. You're just missing air, but that's kind of in there anyway. So when I figured it out, I figured out that Marjorie and Marcus share a great, 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 great grandmother.
Right.
So, and then I also figured out that Marjorie was you.
Yeah. Marjorie shares a lot of my characteristics, but she is her own person.
Well, then, and your acknowledgments, you're dedicating it to the other side of that person. Right? Kind of.
The other, oh.
And your acknowledgments, when you, your last acknowledgement in your book is kind of the corollary.
That's to my boyfriend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because at the end, you have this incredibly disparate sides of a family tree. And then again, well, I'm going to start spoiling it, so I won't do that. But but it's this combination once again at the end, a fire and water and a certain stone is involved. And did you, because then, you know, at the beginning of this book, when you just pinned or tacked the family tree to the wall, and either the characters' names came to you or they didn't, and you would just leave a blank or a question mark.
Right.
Did you have an overarching kind of picture in your mind of how this was going to work? You must have had some type of.
Yeah, I mean, I had a family tree. I did an outline. I kind of knew, I knew the beginning and the end, basically, of this novel, really from starting around 2012, after I'd already been working on it for about 3 years. And I didn't know really anything in the middle. That was kind of the gray area for me. And so I just worked off of that family tree, trying to reach those last two characters who I knew. I knew kind of, you know, kind of vaguely who they were and what I wanted for them.
So at such a young age, especially when you first started this, or actually at the workshop when you first began to think of it, when you come up with characters like Ness and Sam, who I mentioned earlier, and Ness going through hell and Sam eventually coming to realize and in full becoming the man he was, where do you get the experience, or do you get the experience to draw characters that have such goodness in them, notwithstanding all the pain that they're forced to be put through?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that comes from. I think, you know, I've heard people say things like you have to go out and live a full life in order to be able to write. And I am young, and I don't know how much I have done really, but I read a lot. I read a lot, and I try to pay attention to people, and I try to listen. And really just rely heavily on my imagination, which has been a friend to me since I was young. You know, being a writer is something I've wanted to do really basically for my entire life. And so I've been thinking about this for a while, and been trying to tap into my imagination for a while.
Yeah, a lot of people do say that insight comes from experience, but I think intelligent people who do pay attention, I think they can gain insight without having necessarily these strange and exotic life experiences, don't you? I guess you do.
Yeah, no, I definitely do. I think, you know, I think sometimes imagination really is enough, and I don't know what it is that you know, triggers that or makes it deeper or wider than the average person's, but I think sometimes, you know, you don't have to have traveled the entire world in order to be able to write about it.
But like, again, you know, kind of playing devil's advocate, if you look at Quay and his confusion over his situation, and then you look at James, who I thought, okay, he comes running to this person who's willing to wait, but then he becomes like a failure. And it's like, I wasn't expecting that. I was expecting a happy ever after thing, you know,
like a
Disney thing.
Yeah.
Now it's the second time. Now it's this is the first time you've been compared to Disney, too.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, James is a failure, I suppose, in a lot of the senses that matter to us economically. You know, he's not doing well financially. But I think that James would say that he was very happy. You know, he got to live life on his terms with the person that he wanted to live it with. And I don't know how much more, you know, any of us could ask for than that.
That's true. But marriage, as you portrayed, is so complex in this book, whether it's a second marriage, third marriage, or arranged marriages, or in this case, where, you know, James just looks at somebody for one moment and recognizes, is this the person, notwithstanding what's planned for me, this is the person I want to be with forever.
Right.
Do you believe in that?
I don't really believe in, like, soulmates. I've never felt that, you know, I've never looked at someone and thought, this is it. But I know people who have, and, you know, that's great for them. I believe it's possible, but I don't know if I think it really exists.
Yeah, but look at it this way. I mean, you might not think it really exists, but then there's this poem at the end that pretty much describes exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And if you don't believe in love at first sight, it's hard to imagine how you would believe in the idea of being able to hearken back generations to reiterate an event that happened, you know, like I said, forged a fire.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think there are, like, these kind of, I don't know, not to get, like, totally metaphysical, but I think there is something about, like, connecting to somebody's energy, or getting the sense that you are somehow connected to a person, that's, like, not, has nothing to do with, like, romance or romantic love, but just, like, this person is a kindred spirit. There's something in this person that speaks to something inside of me, and that can be something. That can be love, but it can also be friendship. It can also be connection. In the case of those last two characters, it can be family, however you define family. So I definitely believe that. I'm not sure if I believe in soulmates.
I don't know. you and Matthew, at least, if you seem like it, because you walk into the water and that's it. It's like I extended the family tree. You know, I put an M between Marjorie and Marcus. I just drew the line.
Matt, my boyfriend, is not Marcus at all.
Okay. I won't push. Well, then, you know, to go to hell, essentially, when you talk about Akua, do you think that, because I don't look at her as a bad person, and then I was second-guessing myself, how can I not? Everyone's going crazy about the mother who let their kid go into the gorilla cage now today.
Right.
And she didn't really do anything. But this is someone who did a horrible, horrible thing. Because of her life story and remembering and having this denizen of some place constantly berating her and telling her what to do. Do you think everyone has a tipping point like that?
Yeah, I do, actually. I think, you know, talking about, you know, whether or not your childhood or the things that your ancestors did have any effect on you, I think if you are raised in a certain way, in a way that really just punishes you and makes you feel small, and it can come back to you, you know. And I think for Akua, she didn't have much of a chance in a lot of ways. I think, you know, she didn't get a sense of family that wasn't really messed up. And I don't think she's a bad person. I think she does a very bad thing, but I don't think she's a bad person.
And the other thing is, the other side of her relationship is, if I'm pronouncing it right, Asamoah, that he has such the ability to forgive. Against the entire wishes of an entire crowd.
But
it's the same crowd that did the horrible thing that started her off on the wrong path anyway.
Right. Yeah. It's all very complex. I mean, Asamoah seems like just kind of a simple man. Akua talks about his simplicity, how he wasn't, you know, he wasn't like her dream love, but he was a certainty for her. She knew that he would be steady and stable. And then he proves himself to be really, really a great and forgiving man. And pitted against this town that kind of wavers back. They're also in this impossible circumstance. They're losing their nation, essentially. They lost this war, and they're being consumed by the British colony, finally, after hundreds of years of fighting against it. And so it's all very complicated.
Yeah, and that's, you know, and you saying it, I was just going to say the same thing about it being complex and complicated. Yet, and I don't mean this like really as a compliment, but you make it seem, you it's very accessible. When I first looked at it, I go, oh, this is going to be really dense and really difficult. And you make it all very accessible. So maybe every novelist should just like pin a family tree to their wall before they start any book. I try doing that. I make lists, but then I find myself making lists of lists, which essentially doesn't accomplish much. It gives you the feeling of accomplishment. So if you continue to go down the line, say, why does, and Sam, not Sam, who does the two loads of coal the one day for the guy?
Oh, H.
Yes.
Yeah.
H, whose name was never finished.
Right.
He's such a great guy. And why does, when he finally writes that letter, why do you think, it's so funny what you did. Why do people wait? People wait, we've talked about like maybe two or three people who wait. Why does she wait for him? Why does she wait for that letter?
That's a great question. I think she knows him, you know, talking about, you know, that kind of, that kindred spirit thing. I think, you know, she hears the news that he's done something bad, but she doesn't believe it, you know? She doesn't believe what other people are saying about him. And maybe she wants to know for herself. I don't know why she waits. Maybe she doesn't wait, and then, you know, he just finds her at a time where she's free. But for me, I think it was really about, like, the fact that she knew that he wasn't the person that they said he was, you know, that these guards had said that he was.
And that's, like we were talking about, maybe I'll pronounce it better now, Akosua. It's not that she waits, but she's exactly standing in exactly the position he expected her to be in at that moment.
Yeah.
You know? It's really cool, and it really makes you feel like this concept of what love is. And
right.
So I'm surprised you don't believe in love at first sight, that's all. Because you do a lot of it.
But there's also a lot that has nothing to do with love at first sight. There's other love in this book.
That's true. I mean, I tried to like think in my head, who are the bad people, who are the good people? And of course, the bad people are the same bad people as there are in that movie Django Unchained, which is, again, three references that you haven't had yet.
Right.
But the bad people are always the bad people who do those horrible, horrible things. But then your protagonists, I tried to divide in my head who was good and who was bad. And even though a lot of them, most of them, went through these horrible situations, I don't think they were really any bad people.
Yeah, that was something that I was thinking about while writing this book. I think particularly when it comes to things like slavery or these awful moments, we in the present have kind of this tendency to look upon people, our ancestors, and think that we're somehow better or more moral or whatever it is. Like we would have never done the things that they did. And I think it's a lot more complex than that. I think it's a lot grayer than that, you know. I think good people do bad things, bad people do good things. I don't really believe in this kind of just this dichotomy of goodness versus badness. I don't think it exists. Like the percentage of people that are actually sociopathic, I think, is really quite small. And so we can't just pin everything on just somebody's bad, somebody else is good, you know?
Yeah, and that's exactly what, and actually the word sociopathic came to mind when I was reading it, because it was like, well, Sonny's story, which really could have stood alone, because in that last paragraph of that story, you tilt us, right? You tilt the reader the right way. And that's what short stories do. Like, you know, you don't know what's going to happen, but, you know, at that moment, he's tilting the right way.
Right. Right. Yeah.
And you could have easily just two words, three words, just tilted him the other way.
Yeah.
That's what's so powerful. So what's so powerful about being a writer?
Yeah, it is.
And what I was saying earlier is you kind of really kept us on our toes, because as a reader, you know, you're either expecting something or not. Sometimes in your situation, I could compare it to Forrest Gump, and that would be four things. I could do the box of chocolates thing.
Right. You never know what you're going to get. That's true.
Well, so I know you got another one in the works, and I like the way in your interview you go, it doesn't seem anything at all like this one.
Yeah, it's true. It's just, I feel like there's no real way to know how to write a novel. Like, everyone is going to be different. Everyone is going to pose its own separate challenges. And this novel, Homegoing, was a lot of research, and not all of them are like that. So I'm sure, like, every time I start a new novel, it's going to feel just entirely different than the one that came before it.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, I've interviewed, I guess, maybe over 300 authors now, and it's always funny not only to hear the different ways that they begin to write or begin the process, but it's interesting. Mm-hmm. It's interesting the way you've portrayed it, because it's almost as if, and I think you say it this way too, you know, they come to you. Some of them come to you.
Yeah.
And then again, being so young, I mean, even when you were 19 or 20, some of them had apparently already come to you, right?
Yeah. This book I started when I was 20.
Wow. That's
true.
That's amazing. And you really do think it was because of that trip? If you didn't make that trip, do you think this book would exist?
I don't think this book would exist if I hadn't made that trip. I mean, I think something else would exist, but
right.
But I really think that being in that castle and feeling kind of the haunted space of it all was the start of this novel. I don't know if I would have gotten here if it hadn't been for that. Be an entirely different novel.
Well, I do think, you know, as you may know, I have an independent bookstore, and this book will be on our front desk, and hopefully at some point, either this tour or maybe when it goes into paperback, hopefully you can come by the bookstore and do a signing or a reading. I would love that.
That's wonderful.
And I think you know, there is so much acclaim and it is so overwhelming, but I think it will live up this summer to all the acclaim that it's gotten. So I'm very happy for you and proud of the book, and I think you've done a wonderful job.
So thank you so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure talking to you. Hope we can talk again.
Absolutely. It was great.
That was Yaa Jesse, who wrote Homegoing. Just came out June 7th by Knopf. And like I said, I'll say this now, it's been hyped like crazy. And at first, when I looked at it, I thought, well, this isn't the kind of book I would normally read. And then the family tree kind of scared me off and all that. But once you get into it, actually what happened was, you know, normally if I find a book entrancing, I'm just going to stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock. And what happened here was kind of different. I was reading it, and I fell asleep. And then I woke up like 2 hours later, and I said, you know what, I got to go finish this. So I went downstairs, went into my library, and just sat down and finished it. And then I got up, and I went back upstairs and went to sleep and dreamt about it. So you can't say much more about a book than that. So I would highly recommend it. It's Yaa Jesse, Homegoing, and published by Knopf, released earlier this month. And we got, coming up, we got the New York Times bestselling author Mark Kurlansky. He's going to discuss his latest book, Paper, Paging Through History, which is about the history of paper, which sounds boring, but it's really interesting. And then Ellen Whalen-Smith, who's going to discuss her fascinating history of the Oneida Flatware Company, which sounds boring too, but really isn't, because it derives from the Oneida community, which was a free love utopian community. And it's a fascinating story of kind of a transformation of one group into a company. And then lastly, at least the next few, is Arturo Perez Reverte, who's going to discuss his highly anticipated new novel, What We Become. And so if you want a complete schedule, you can visit us at wellingtonsquarebooks.com, WCHE1520.com, or you can simply download our podcast, subscribe to them At iTunes or at Podomatic. And then, as I've noted, we have two YouTube channels, one that broadcasts the actual interview and one that's called 1Q1A, which is the author being asked and answering a question in a minute or so. And it really does give you quickly some insight into the author's mind and soul and an answer to a very important question that you may agree with, disagree with, or simply find interesting. So thanks, as always, for joining us here today, and I look forward to you being back here again to listen to us on The Avid Reader.